The dream of a benevolent welfare state may live on in social work theory, conference papers, and mission statements, but as far as frontline bureaucracy goes, welfare is dead. This is the opening line to the recent article, Discipline and Punish, Welfare, Workfare, and the Punishment of the Poor, written by Alexandra McHugh. It appeared in the November and December edition of Briar Patch magazine. Alexandra is a writer and an editor of the Regina-based magazine Utilitarian Donuts. Peter from Worm's Eye View caught up with Alexandra by phone from Regina. He began by asking her to describe what welfare looked like at its strongest in Canadian history.
Well, there's a lot of mythology surrounding welfare that tends to see the period when, a very short period, when it was first instituted sort of in the mid-60s to maybe the early 70s as being its high point. Some people mark its gradual decline starting as early as the oil crisis in the early 70s. And sort of from there, market going away from sort of just providing people with assistance to increasingly attaching work obligations to becoming more targeted to sort of seeing fewer classes of recipients as legitimate recipients. And so if it did have a heyday, it was relatively short. And then there's sort of been periods, say, when the free trade era started in the 80s with the Mulroney government, and you had Mulroney and Thatcher and Reagan. There's a huge sort of overhaul that happened in that period in the late 80s. And then again in the mid-90s, under the Martin Chrétien government, there was a lot of dismantling. That's when the Canada Assistance Plan was actually replaced with the Canada Health and Social Transfer. And what that did was it took away what had been the national standards for welfare, which some people have seen loosely sort of as rights, although they weren't enforceable, which entitled us as a principle to an income when in need, to the right to choose work freely, and a number of other principles, and removed dedicated funding for income assistance, wrapped it up with education and health care, you may remember, in the mid-90s. And so that was another period of fundamental change. But then, you know, that those national shifts just opened the door to allow a lot of regional experimentation. It's been seen as sort of empowering different provinces and regions to do as they would see fit. But it also, you know, removed a lot of national funding, and it you know, allowed a lot of variation. Nonetheless, that variation has tended to go in a certain direction toward reducing benefits, toward becoming more restrictive, you know, allowing fewer people to be eligible, becoming more punitive. I can talk more about a number of policies that have made it more punitive. And the way these things tend to spread is that different jurisdictions get ideas from each other, and that can go across, you know, regions and provinces, across national boundaries. And so the general orientation, not just in Canada, but in the U.S., in other countries that have been said to have welfare states, you know, operating within a global liberalized trade environment, have all tend to sort of pursue that direction on the whole, although there are some countervailing examples.
So. Yeah, maybe some of those counter examples would be great. Are there any in Canada where, now that there's no national standard, where you think there is still a good standard?
Well, not overall. In terms of, like, you know, each social services ministry, it's made up of hundreds of eligibility rules and policies and that operate under their regulations, their legislation. And so there are changes to sort of individual policies that are progressive. And I couldn't say exactly what produces those things, but for instance, in Manitoba, it's gone against the grain to allow people who are applying for income assistance to keep a certain amount of savings and still qualify for income assistance. That's very much against the grain and is sort of an oddity. And Because typically people on income assistance in most provinces, the ones I'm aware of anyway, really allow people very minimal savings, sometimes no savings. I mean, BC is one of the worst provinces that I know of. Again, there's some I don't know much about. You know, typically people have to actually be pretty much in a state of destitution, prove that they have nothing in their savings account, prove that they have nothing in terms of assets that they could liquidate to get money. And they're also not allowed to, they're allowed to keep very few of their earnings if they are able to get earnings on top of income assistance. So to see a policy like that, you know, that's one policy that's sort of operating in what is still a generally very regressive overall system that would still help people. And it may be, I don't know that much about Manitoba. I know they don't seem to need as much in terms of advocates, legal advocates to help people navigate their system. So that to me is a sign that it's must be far better than, say, British Columbia, where you have a whole shadow network of advocates with many of them with legal training that are actually required routinely to help people navigate the ministry's policies, procedures, and legislation. And that's just for people to get what they're legally entitled to according to the ministry's own legislation. So the fact that Manitoba doesn't have that elaborate system, you know, tells me, it's just a province I haven't studied very much, tells me that they're probably a lot better off than, say, a BC or Ontario, which I have looked at more.
And could you describe for us, for if you were an individual who's trying to get onto income assistance or welfare, what it's like trying to navigate that system of different requirements? Like, what does that look like on the ground here in BC?
Well, I think, first off, in BC, and, you know, I haven't been there for a few years, but I from what I read, it's pretty much the same as when I was there. The ministry starts off with an adversarial position towards its what it calls its clients and its potential clients. And so its whole thrust is to discourage people from applying, to make it very difficult to qualify, and to create all sorts of frustrations and penalties along the way, because it doesn't want people on the rolls. It has a very cost recovery orientation, very much sort of a zero tolerance and sort of orientation, and a lot of negatives. Like, it just wants to have as few people as possible on income assistance, which might sound positive or negative, but at any rate, because of that, tactics it uses is just to make it hard. Like, I've read that the BC Helpline, for example, that it's very hard for people to even initially make contact with the ministry. So what it's done is just remove accessibility to people, particularly in rural areas, to make it very hard to actually even make initial contact with a worker to apply. When I was there, it was in an early 2000 period where the BC Liberals had come in, and they did a whole overhaul of their disability legislation and wanted to make it far more restrictive. They wanted a lot fewer people qualifying for disability, for the Disability 2 legislation, where they would be sort of receive a reprieve from work obligations. So they made that criteria just far more complicated, all sorts of hoops that people have to jump through, going to doctors. The doctors have to word their support in a very specific way, or it won't be seen as supporting the person receiving benefits. And then just, you know, setting up employability contracts for people, essentially just creating just a barrage of rules and hoops and denying people benefits outright, right? Seeming to have a policy to deny people the first time, requiring people to go through appeals, which, and to have the help of people with legal training in order to have them interpret the forms that they're filling out, know how they're supposed to submit them, know how to go through an appeal process, you know, just all sorts of things like that. It can be extremely frustrating. And you can imagine, especially for people who typically, if they're unemployed, have a lot of stressors already. Everything, you know, a large range of stressors, which can be at one end, you know, extreme illness, difficulty getting around, destitution, homelessness, just all sorts of things that they're already dealing with in their life, and then encountering a ministry that is trying to make things as difficult as possible because it wants as few people as possible to qualify for benefits.
Well, I'm a university student who's constantly trying to navigate my own university's bureaucracy, and they want me to be here. I can't fathom going through that in a system that doesn't want you to be there with all the many more hoops.
Exactly. Yeah. Not that bureaucracies are friendly, but this bureaucracy is extraordinarily unfriendly. Yeah.
And you mentioned how just briefly there about how employment fits into that, and you go into that in depth in your article. Can you describe the connection between the welfare system and the labor market?
Sure. The problem is that that there right now income assistance policy and the actual reality of the job market are pitted against each other, because the job market, as most of us know and have experienced, is made up increasingly of part-time, short-term jobs, low-paying jobs. You know, this is something everybody sort of knows, because that a large number of jobs are that, and because there aren't enough of even those jobs, you know, which leaves a certain number of people out from having a job. So because a certain number of the jobs are those jobs that can't provide people with a living, people are put in a position where really it's a forced choice. Their choice is between sort of living in extreme poverty for Canada. It's not absolute poverty as you would experience in another country, but extreme poverty in Canada, you know, either that is employed or unemployed, because those are the jobs that are available. And the income assistance, why I say they're pitted against each other, is because in order for people to climb out of poverty, say if they received income assistance, they would have to have those two working together. They would need their, say, $500 or $600 from income assistance, and then be allowed to keep whatever money they earned from a job. And then if they were allowed to do that, perhaps with those two things together, they would be able to move themselves out of poverty. As it stands now, and this is in every province, you know, and though the amounts vary, people are only allowed to keep, if they're on income assistance, living in you know, well, far, far below a poverty line, any poverty line, they can only keep, you know, sometimes it's $50, $100 before the ministry starts taking their earnings back. Because, again, that's a cost recovery of the ministry. So the idea is, as soon as people are earning money, well, they should start, you know, living on their own. The problem with that is it doesn't allow anyone to get out of poverty. Now, obviously, those people, the ministry, not caring or not being primarily concerned with the unworkability of that situation, continues to try to force people to choose work over income assistance. But the jobs that are available to most people, particularly people who have been unemployed off and on, or have been taking care of children, people who are at the bottom of the labor market, those are the jobs that they can get. And so the ministry, effectively, what happens is that people just stay in destitution, and that's actually their choice. Their choice is between employed destitution and unemployed destitution, which isn't a good place to stay. You can't stay there for long. And actually, I don't think, really be an employee, function as an employee, you know?
There is obviously fights to increase welfare rates. But what do you think needs to be changed with the welfare system?
I actually am of the view, and once you wade into this area, you actually find a lot of people who are also of the view that it is just so dysfunctional and so irrational that any solution needs to come outside of welfare, something different. Basic income guarantee is what I would focus on. which would be something like we have the guaranteed income supplement that we have for seniors, or like a tax child tax benefit that just gives a certain amount of money to people, to every person in Canada. Some people use the word citizen in Canada, but let's say to every person living in Canada, and a certain amount for children, and really just allows people to do then on top of that money whatever they would choose to do, to choose, you know, to advance their position further, to, you know, start a business, to take a part-time job. It would just be an enabling income. So in some ways that resembles the welfare system. But why I don't think this decades-old fight to just raise the income assistance rates, which has been, you know, that's a usual focus of anti-poverty groups, you know, and I have often agreed with that. I've been part of anti-poverty groups, and I've just come to see that really a lot of what's wrong with it is a lot of the worst of it actually isn't about income. That, yes, that's part of it. That's the most obvious thing. Is that, and the most sort of measurable thing is that, yes, people are living in deep poverty, but what about the way people are being, you know, treated? What about having a whole system that's set up to antagonize people? What about marking out whole classes of people and saying that we're going to treat them differently? We're going to assume the worst about them, and you know, and then we're going to treat them as though they're untrustworthy. And basically, the only our policy is going to be one that's punitive toward them, where the way we're going to try to encourage them to do what we want them to do, which is to accept any job available, is that we're just going to make the alternatives very, very hard for them. And so I've just come to see that it's more the quality of the relationship with social assistance, the whole assumption that you have these classes of people that should be treated this way by the bureaucracy that should be serving them, and that all of that is, and that eligibility, frankly, is a farce. And so if you were just to raise the rates, but people still had to go through everything that they have to go through to then get a higher level of income, I'm not really sure how much that would really improve people's lives.
But what you're describing also comes really close to kind of our everyday cultural, I would say neoliberal discourse about, you know, no such thing as a free ride, and here if everyone has a guaranteed income. I'm wondering what you think about that.
We have this idea that if people are punished, if they're put into a hard situation, that enables them to be their best self, that enables them to go to job interviews, that enables them to work, to be productive, to use their talents and creativity. I would rather argue that what we can see all around us is that when you put people down, at some point they'll give up, particularly if it's a totally unworkable situation. They'll develop illnesses, they'll, you know, pursue other ways of making income that aren't as socially productive. Whereas if you are enabling, supporting people, it just involves a different view of humanity. I'd say that there's evidence all around us, again, that people, if given a little bit of support, will try to pursue their dreams, will try to use their talents, will try to... That's the vast majority of people will do that.
That was Peter from Worm's Eye View speaking with writer Alexandra McHugh. She is the author of the article Discipline and Punish: Welfare, Workfare, and the Punishment of the Poor. If you would like to read that article, you can visit www.briarpatchmagazine.com and look in the November-December edition.
You're listening to Worm's Eye View Grassroots News on CJSF 90.1 FM, broadcasting live from Burnaby Mountain.